Annoyed at this interruption, they told him to play it in his room. When he wouldn't budge, they just went off to their bedroom and shut the door. He stood in front of their closed door and played and played. They may have been trying to teach him a lesson, but he felt humiliated and abandoned. Finally, he curled up on the floor and went to sleep. By the time Chris started working with me, he had studied with several spiritual teachers, moving from one to the next in part because, as he put it, he had never really felt seen by any of them. In spending time with the most recent, a rabbi, Chris found himself feeling very young and insecure. He tried to curry favor by playing guitar at the temple's social gatherings, by showing off his knowledge in Kabbalah classes. Whenever possible, he'd strike up a conversation with the rabbi, who was perfectly friendly in response. But Chris didn't get the sense that he mattered, that the rabbi would even notice if he didn't show up. Chris believed that if he did not stand out as a special person, he was worthless. The need to be number one extended to dating, friendship, and work. Unless he was the center of attention, he felt he was being overlooked or rejected. Admitting this in our therapy sessions was embarrassing. He felt something was wrong with him for being so dependent on outside recognition. Chris was afraid that his neediness and insecurity would prevent him from ever finding love in his life. It drives women away. As soon as they sense it, they are turned off. It didn't seem to help that he had learned how to hold back from making overt demands or asking for reassurances. "It's my vibe," he told me. The intensity of his unfulfilled desires made him feel that he was unappealing and deserved to be rejected. Our sense of self emerges from the ground level of all experience, our reactivity to intense, pleasant, or unpleasant sensations. When we want loving attention, like Chris, we are feeling certain sensations in our body, perhaps the aching of longing around the heart, as well as excitement and openness. When the answer to our need and desire is no, the physical sensations of contraction we experience are intense. We feel shame, the desire to hide, and the danger of fear. When we experience this wanting and not getting over and over, we make an enduring association. Our wanting leads to fear and shame. This intense cluster of reactive feelings, locked in the body, forms the energetic core of a wanting self. We identify ourselves with these persistent feelings through the eyeing and maying talked about by Ajahn Buddhadasa. The tension and excitement of wanting arise, and we experience this as my longing for intimacy, my craving for touch and attention. In the same way, it's my fear and shame when I am rejected. We consolidate our sense of a wanting self as we tell ourselves stories about what is happening. Something is wrong with me for wanting so much. Why don't I already have what I want? The world has it in for me, and I never get anything. If we haven't had to deal with major threats to our physical survival, the wanting self is primarily focused on emotional survival and well-being. We all have, to some degree, experienced fear and shame when our basic needs to feel loved and understood are frustrated. If, like Chris, our needs for connection are consistently ignored or misunderstood, our wanting grows stronger, and we seek even more urgently the attention we crave. We spend our lives trying to get away from our painful feelings of fear and shame, disconnecting from and numbing our body, getting lost in self-judgment and obsessive thinking. But this only serves to increase our wanting and shame. As the cycle of reactivity repeats itself over and over, our identity as a wanting self, fundamentally deprived, isolated, and unworthy, deepens. When we can't meet our emotional needs directly, the wanting self develops strategies for satisfying them with substitutes. Like all strategies underlying the trance of unworthiness, those aimed at winning love and respect absorb and fixate our attention. We might, like Chris, be compelled to get attention by impressing others with our talent and knowledge. We might drive ourselves relentlessly to make money or have power over others. We might desperately pursue sexual conquests. Or we might feel compelled to be helpful and of service, someone needed by others. We often try to satisfy our emotional needs with the more immediate pleasures of food, alcohol, and drugs. When they work, these strategies provide immediate gratification through a temporary surge of pleasant sensations. They also numb or cover over the raw pain of shame and fear. But because they don't genuinely address our needs, our suffering continues, and with it, our reliance on whatever provides pleasure or relief. Our most regularly used strategies to get what we want also become a defining part of our sense of self. The overeating, the competing, the people-pleasing feel like me. As we immerse ourselves in the life-consuming pursuit of substitutes, we become increasingly alienated from our authentic desires, our deepest longings for love and belonging. Lost in the pursuit of substitutes. Ever since I was a teen, my drive to be productive has been a key strategy of my wanting self. When I feel insecure, producing, whether it is a finished article, a stack of paid bills, or a clean kitchen, is my most readily accessible device for feeling worthwhile. This producing is not simply the natural urge to be creative and contribute to the mix of life. It is energized by fears of inadequacy and the need to prove myself. When I'm caught in the strategy, I turn to English breakfast tea to give me the boost I think I need to remain productive throughout the day and often into the night. The price is that I become speedy, impatient, and distant from those I love. I get disconnected from my body as I relentlessly urge myself onward to get yet another thing done. Feeling self-centered and bad about myself for workaholism doesn't slow me down. Getting one more thing out of the way seems the most reliable way to get what I want, to feel better. At a psychotherapy conference I attended, I saw a poster that struck home. In it, two homeless men are sitting on a park bench. One is saying to the other, "I used to have a private jet, condo in Aspen and be the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. Then I switch to decaf." It's not hard to understand why our substitutes are so attractive. Even if they don't address our deepest needs, they prop us up and for a time keep getting us the goods that give us those momentary pleasant sensations. Our efforts in pursuit of substitutes preoccupy and distract our attention enough to shield us for a time from the raw sensations of feeling unloved or unworthy. Accomplishing things does temporarily stave off my feelings of inadequacy. Yet underneath, my wanting self urges me on, fearful that without being productive, I'll lose everything, like the executive who switched to decaf. While having a job is usually necessary to meet our basic survival needs, where and how we work is also a key domain for substitute gratification. Work becomes an indirect means for trying to win love and respect. We might find what we do entirely meaningless. We might hate or resent our job, yet still hitch our desire for approval and connection to how well we perform. While this is true for men in particular, most of us rely on work to help us make up for fears of unworthiness. This strategy delivers the goods through money or power, through the strokes we get for our diligence and competence, through the satisfaction of getting something done. But we can get lost in these substitutes, overlooking the fact that they will never satisfy our deepest longings. Even when we are engaged in activities that are meaningful to us, that are creatively and spiritually gratifying, they can be co-opted and used to satisfy the unmet needs of the wanting self. This happens to me most often when I'm preparing talks or workshops for meditation groups or writing articles on Buddhist practice. When I remain aware that the Buddhist teachings are precious to me and I love sharing them with others, I can throw myself into what I'm doing with enormous passion. When anxiety or frustration arises, I am able to meet it with acceptance. But sometimes that voice of insecurity and unworthiness arises, and I listen to it. Suddenly, writing or preparing a presentation is linked to winning or losing love and respect, and my entire experience of working shifts. The wanting self takes over. While I always intend to give a wholehearted effort, now that effort is wrapped in fear. I'm anxiously striving to be good enough and to reap the rewards. My love for what I do is clouded over when working becomes a strategy to prove my worth. We are unable to give ourselves freely and joyfully to any activity if the wanting self is in charge. And yet, until we attend to the basic desires and fears that energize the wanting self, it will insinuate itself into our every activity and relationship. D.H. Lawrence wrote, "Men are not free when they are doing just what they like. Men are only free when they are doing what the deepest self likes." When we are motivated by immediate gratification to do just what we like, we will feel continuously driven. No amount of productivity or consuming or recognition can break through the trance of unworthiness and put us in touch with the deepest self. As Lawrence points out, to do what the deepest self likes takes some diving. To listen and respond to the longing of our heart requires a committed and genuine presence. The more completely we're caught in the surface world of pursuing substitutes, the harder it is to dive. When addictive wanting takes over our life. As I discovered with my Vipassana romance, when desire gets strong, mindfulness goes out the window. Willa Cather tells us, there is only one big thing, desire. And before it, when it is big, all is little. We can honor desire as a life force, but still see how it causes suffering when it takes over our life. Our natural hunger for food can become an ungovernable craving for food, ice cream, sweets, potato chips, comfort food, or food to numb our feelings. Our longing for sex and affection can become an anguished dependency on another human being to define and please us. Our need for shelter and clothing can turn into insatiable greed, compelling us to possess 3 houses and closets full of unworn shoes. Our fundamental longing to belong and feel loved becomes an insistent craving for substitutes. If we have been acutely frustrated or deprived, our fixated desire becomes desperate and unquenchable. We are possessed by craving, and our entire life is hijacked by the force of this energy. We feel like a wanting self in all situations with all people throughout the day. In India, it is said that when a pickpocket sees a saint, he or she sees only the saint's pockets. If we are taken over by craving, no matter who or what is before us, all we can see is how it might satisfy our needs. This kind of thirst contracts our body and mind into a profound trance. We move through the world with a kind of tunnel vision that prevents us from enjoying what is in front of us. The color of the autumn leaves, or a passage of poetry, merely amplifies the feeling that there is a gaping hole in our life. The smile of a child only reminds us that we are painfully childless. We turn away from simple pleasures because our craving compels us to seek more intense stimulation or numbing relief. Addictive craving is extremely difficult to endure without acting out. As Oscar Wilde put it, "I can resist anything but temptation." Temptation is an emotional promise that we will experience the pleasure we so intensely crave. Anyone who has struggled with smoking, compulsive overeating, or drug or relationship addictions, knows the compelling force of these physical and mental urges. We don't want to forego the cigarette and take a nice walk, listen to soothing music, breathe deeply. We just want what we want. While we might consciously recognize that the fix is a temporary substitute, we still feel we have to have it. Sarah, a meditation student who had struggled with compulsive overeating for many years, arrived at a 10-day Buddhist retreat panicked about how she would handle food. Would she get enough? Would she like what was served? Would she eat too much? She dreaded sitting at the long dining tables in silence, and without the comforting veil of conversation, eating in front of others. She feared that somehow the people around her would be able to tell by watching her that she had an eating disorder. She imagined that she would feel unbearable shame. During the first few days of retreat, food was center stage in her awareness. When the gong sounded announcing a meal, she left the meditation hall and walked slowly toward the dining room. She told me her mindfulness was a pretense. She felt as if an irresistible magnet were pulling her. While waiting to get food in the lunch line, she was squeezed by anxiety and excitement. As she ate what she had on her plate, she would plan what more she was going to get. Sarah found the food good and plentiful, so much so that she went back for seconds, sometimes thirds. Rather than sit in her original seat, she would take the additional servings to other parts of the dining hall. At our first interview, Sarah said she felt riddled to the core with obsession and craving. She felt horrible shame about being such a failure, being so unspiritual. The hardest part was that no matter how much she wanted to control her eating, no matter what her plans and intentions, she couldn't stop herself from overeating. More than anything, these futile daily attempts to control herself made her feel like a failure. While we often don't like ourselves when caught in wanting, this dislike turns to full-blown aversion when wanting gets out of control and takes over our life. We see how we ruin our bodies and our relationships by binging on food or alcohol. We see how we hurt our children when we are addicted to endless achieving. We watch ourselves sabotage intimate relationships when we are driven by neediness and insecurity. As one student described it, "My wanting self is my worst enemy." When we hate ourselves for wanting, it is because the wanting self has taken over our entire life. Desperate to get away from the pain of self-hatred, we send cruel and unforgiving messages to our wanting self. We may try to punish our wanting self by depriving ourselves of food, rest, or another person's comfort. We might so badly want to destroy the part of ourself that is wrecking our life that we recklessly injure our body or mind. As with Sarah, our agonizing shame of addiction takes over and prevents us from sensing what the deepest self likes. We remain out of touch with the longing for love that drives our addiction in the first place.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Rejecting the wanting self. In the myth of Eden, God created the garden and dropped the tree of knowledge, with its delicious and dangerous fruits, right smack dab in the middle. He then deposited some humans close by and forbade these curious, fruit-loving creatures from taking a taste. It was a setup. Eve naturally grasped at the fruit and then was shamed and punished for having done so. We experience this situation daily inside our own psyche. We are encouraged by our culture to keep ourselves comfortable, to be right, to possess things, to be better than others, to look good, to be admired. We are also told that we should feel ashamed of our selfishness, that we are flawed for being so self-centered, sinful when we are indulgent. Most mainstream religions, Judeo-Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, Confucian, teach that our wanting, passion, and greed cause suffering. While this certainly can be true, their blanket teachings about the dangers of desire often deepen self-hatred. We are counseled to transcend, overcome, or somehow manage the hungers of our physical and emotional being. We are taught to mistrust the wildness and intensity of our natural passions, to fear being out of control. Audre Lorde tells us, "We have been raised to fear our deepest cravings, and the fear of our deepest cravings keeps them suspect, keeps us docile and loyal and obedient, and leads us to settle for many facets of our own oppression." Equating spiritual purity with elimination of desire is a common misunderstanding I also see in students on the Buddhist path. This is not just a contemporary issue. The struggle to understand the relationship between awakening and desire in the context of the Buddhist teachings has gone on since the time of the Buddha himself. A classical Chinese Zen tale brings this to light. An old woman had supported a monk for 20 years, letting him live in a hut on her land. After all this time, she figured the monk, now a man in the prime of life, must have attained some degree of enlightenment. So she decided to test him. Rather than taking his daily meal to him herself, she asked a beautiful young girl to deliver it. She instructed the girl to embrace the monk warmly, and then to report back to her how he responded. When the girl returned, she said that the monk had simply stood stock still, as if frozen. The old woman then headed for the monk's hut. "What was it like," she asked him, "when he felt the girl's warm body against his?" With some bitterness, he answered, "Like a withering tree on a rock in winter, utterly without warmth." Furious, the old woman threw him out and burned down his hut, exclaiming, "How could I have wasted all these years on such a fraud?" To some, the monk's response might seem virtuous. After all, he resisted temptation. He even seemed to have pulled desire out by the roots. Still, the old woman considered him a fraud. Is his way of experiencing the young girl like a withering tree on a rock in winter the point of spiritual practice? Instead of appreciating the girl's youth and loveliness, instead of noting the arising of a natural sexual response and its passing away without acting on it, the monk shut down. This is not enlightenment. I have worked with many meditation students who have gotten the message that experiencing desire is a sign of being spiritually undeveloped. While it is true that withdrawing attention from certain impulses can diminish their strength, the continued desire for simple pleasures, delicious foods, play, entertainment, or sexual gratification, need not be embarrassing evidence of being trapped in lower impulses. Those same students also assume that spiritual people are supposed to call on inner resources as their only refuge, and so they rarely ask for comfort or help from their friends and teachers. I've talked with some of them who have been practicing spiritual disciplines for years, yet have never let themselves acknowledge that they are lonely and long for intimacy. As the monk in the Zen tale shows, if we push away desire, we disconnect from our tenderness, and we harden against life. We become like a rock in winter. When we reject desire, we reject the very source of our love and aliveness. It's not my fault. At our next interview, Sarah told me she had been participating in Overeaters Anonymous, OA, a 12-step recovery program, for several years before she decided to try a Vipassana retreat. She had made significant headway in OA. When she felt strong cravings, she now phoned her sponsor instead of directly heading for the refrigerator. This is what I would call an assisted pause. Together, they could look at what she was feeling and explore some options on how to respond. Nevertheless, the eating binges had continued. And each time she went to an OA meeting and introduced herself as a compulsive overeater, she felt as if she were further binding her identity to being an addict. Sarah had come to the retreat hoping that meditation and prayer, the 11th of OA's 12 steps, might help her release the grip of addiction. Now, several days into the retreat, Sarah told me she was doubting herself even more. Without the distractions of daily life, the force of addiction and the enormity of her shame seemed more oppressive than ever. Whenever she tried to pause and pay attention to her craving for food, the agitation she felt was unbearable. Every cell in her body seemed to be reaching out to fill an impossibly big hole inside. Sarah was convinced that something was so deeply wrong with her that it could never be fixed. I asked Sarah to close her eyes and sense into the worst part of what she was experiencing, what most wanted attention. She immediately said that, right in that moment, she wanted me to have a good impression of her. I encouraged her to bring presence to what that want was like, noticing it as a felt sense in her body. "There's a jumpiness in my chest," she reported. As we went on, I suggested she remain open to any emotion, image, or words that might naturally appear. When emotions surged up that felt too painful or consuming to be with, I reminded her to silently say to herself, "This too," and with a gentle attention, focus on the sensations in her body. As we sat together, Sarah softly named the unfolding stream of what she was experiencing. "Jitteriness in my stomach. Fear I'm not going to do this exercise right. Anger. Thinking I'm taking too much of your time. Another thought, you must think I'm a real basket case. Soreness, squeezing around my heart. Another thought, this is what I always feel when someone pays attention or cares about me. Longing. Trembling. I want to be loved. Sadness." We sat together for about 5 more minutes while Sarah continued to give each wave of judgment or feeling a respectful attention. Eventually, she began noticing more moments of calm. Before we ended our interview, I suggested she continue to practice this way on her own. It might be hard to do when that overwhelming craving arose, I acknowledged. But even if she could manage for a few minutes to remain aware, she would be setting in motion a process that could make a profound difference. I could see a little gleam of hope in her eyes as she thanked me and left. When she arrived at our next interview, 4 days later, Sarah seemed calmer. Her eyes were bright. She had been meditating late one afternoon, she told me, and managed to note pretty continuously her inner stream of experience, as she had during our interview. She hadn't gotten lost very often in her usual thoughts about how bad she was for what she was feeling. She hadn't even gotten lost when her mouth watered and her stomach tightened when she smelled the cookies baking for tea time. Sarah had begun seeing how even the most acute cravings eventually subsided if she just sat still, named what was happening, and instead of wishing they'd go away, just said, "This too." Suddenly it became clear that all my desires and thoughts and feelings are an endless changing parade, she told me. And then, with a look of surprise, she added, "I'm not making it happen." For Sarah, this experience of an uncontrollable, ever-changing reality was a breakthrough that dramatically shifted how she related to herself. She wasn't controlling what was going on inside her, and she never had. She had not asked to be filled with craving. She couldn't stop the barrage of obsessive thoughts. She described how, during that meditation, she heard a voice whispering, "It's not my fault. It's never been my fault." It wasn't Sarah's fault that she was so filled with fear, so obsessed, so ashamed. It wasn't her fault that when her feelings got intolerable, she would reach out for food. As she told me this, Sarah started sobbing deeply, grieving all the moments of her life spent in blaming herself for her addiction to food, for her sneaking and pretending, for her insecurity when she was around others. Many streams of conditioning give rise to the wanting self, and the particular forms our craving takes. In Sarah's case, the genetic makeup she inherited included a predisposition to some types of addiction. She was influenced by her mother's drinking, which had bathed Sarah in alcohol even in utero. She was also affected by having a mother who was too depressed and filled with self-hatred to give her real support, and a father who was emotionally distant and critical. She was living in a culture that promised satisfaction through consuming. And most fundamental, like all living beings, she was biologically primed to grasp after pleasure and avoid pain. When I urge students to consider the chain of causes that may have led to their suffering, some take issue. Isn't that just an intellectual way to place blame on someone else and sidestep responsibility? So what if my parents neglected me? Does that give me the license to be impatient with my children? Selfish with my spouse? It's certainly easy enough to say we do hurtful things to others because we were treated poorly when we were children. Yet something quite different happens when we inquire into our conditioning mindfully. I might ask a person whose parents had been neglectful to pause and honestly sense what that experience had been like. Can they feel the enormous hunger for attention that might have developed in those circumstances? How might they still need to feed themselves, even when others are asking to be fed? In bringing a clear and comprehensive awareness to our situation, we begin to accept our wanting self with compassion. This frees us to move forward, to break out of old patterns. By realizing that cravings and overeating were not her fault, Sarah interrupted the painful chain of reactivity that had been driving her addiction. Merely recognizing, as she had in OA, that she was clinging to food as a substitute had not been enough to break the pattern. Forgiving and accepting the presence of the wanting self was the giant step in Sarah's transformation. Although she had to continue consciously forgiving and letting go when craving arose, when she stopped blaming herself, her ability to be present was no longer compromised by overwhelming shame. Awakening from the wanting self. Over the remaining 3 days of the retreat, Sarah practiced accepting even the most excruciating wants and fears by letting herself feel them directly in her body. When she was haunted by the fear that she would never change and get better, she said, "This too," and felt the bands of tightness squeezing her chest and throat. When she doubted that anyone could ever love someone so wretched, she held the fear with, "This too." When the despairing feeling that something is wrong with me seemed to take over her world, she let herself feel the grief like a swelling balloon in her heart. When craving arose, impelling her toward the relief of food, she stayed still and responded to its urgent force with, "This too." As Sarah was discovering in meditation, she could experience even the most intense craving without pushing it away or acting on it. Instead of hating her experience or losing herself in a swirl of mental activity, Sarah was saying yes to the feelings of urgency and tension and fear. Instead of trying to satisfy her craving, she was simply letting it express itself and move through her. Sarah took a courageous step when she carried the acceptance and presence she had practiced into the arena of her greatest struggles, the dining hall. She found she was able to pay closer attention by slowing down everything she did, walking, ladling out portions of food, bringing her fork to her mouth, chewing her food. Slowing down like this was a modified way of pausing. She told me, There were meals when one serving was enough. I could enjoy each bite because I was really there. Being so present made me feel full. When the impulse to stand up and get more food did arise, she would remain seated, mentally saying, "This too." Feeling fully the sharp edge of tension, the squeeze of excitement, anticipation, anxiety. Sometimes the impulse would pass. Other times it didn't, and the compulsion to eat and numb her inner turmoil would keep building. If the voice of judgment arose, she would mentally whisper, "It's not my fault. It's not my fault." The reminder helped her become more gentle and open, more relaxed about the intensity of her craving. If Sarah did choose to get more food after pausing, she could accept that choice with compassion rather than condemn it or feel embarrassed as if she had failed. By pausing and forgiving herself for the feeling of desire, Sarah had cleared the way to radical acceptance. By the time the retreat ended, Sarah felt as if the grip of her addiction had begun to loosen. While the compulsions were still there, she had found a powerful and liberating way to relate to them. After hugging goodbye, she told me, "If I can remember even one time out of 10 to say it's not my fault, I'll be a significantly happier and freer person." She went on, "If I can just forgive myself and be present, I'll be okay." Sarah and I spoke by phone several times in the months following that retreat. She was being considered as a candidate to head the English department at the university where she taught, a position she had wanted for years. As the deadline for the final choice drew near, her tension mounted, and so did her craving for late-night snacks. She told me that one evening after midnight, she found herself in front of the refrigerator, about to get out the milk for another bowl of cereal. But this time, she remembered to pause. She took her hand off the handle and walked slowly and deliberately over to the kitchen table, pulled out a chair, and mindfully sat down. She could feel the racing in her chest, but she sat very still and sent a message to herself. "Craving for food and obsessing about the job are not my fault." As Sarah paid attention to the churning thoughts and feelings of anxiety, she realized that she not only wanted this professional success, she also deeply feared the feeling of failure that could swamp her if she wasn't selected. The tightness and pressure in her chest were so overwhelming she could barely breathe. She wanted relief. She wanted food. But as Sarah continued to pay attention to the explosive restlessness of craving, the massive pressure began to release. She felt a dissolving and opening through her chest, a growing sense of space. Filling that space was a vibrating tenderness. Sarah could now feel how deeply she longed to be accepted, valued, loved. As Sarah listened with a compassionate presence to her unfolding experience of wanting, she was freeing herself from its grip. At the end of the month, Sarah was invited to assume the position of department head. She was thrilled. This was a dream come true in her professional life. But her real triumph was a growing inner freedom. She was learning that she could accept rather than flee from or cover over her desires and cravings. She trusted that when her anxiety and judgments about her performance at work would inevitably arise, rather than reflexively turning toward food, she could offer herself a forgiving and kind presence. Many students ask me if, after years of spiritual practice, we become free of the tug of wanting. They want to know whether we will still feel painfully attached to certain people, compulsive about working, dependent on chocolate, romance novels, or the extra beer to carry us through a lonely evening. While these tendencies may persist, they often unfold to reveal complexes of wanting and shame that, in the light of mindfulness, relax their hold on us. If we, like Sarah, have been deeply deprived emotionally, the habits of clinging or full-blown addictive behaviors will most likely be persistent and strong. Nonetheless, with time, although such wanting may continue to arise, even its most compelling and tenacious expressions need not lead to suffering. The sensations of anxiety and wanting may be unpleasant, but as we saw with pain, the suffering can be optional. We suffer when our experience of desire or craving defines and confines our experience of who we are. If we meet the sensations, emotions, and thoughts of wanting with radical acceptance, we begin to awaken from the identity of a wanting self and to reconnect with the fullness of our being. Whether we are on a meditation retreat or in the midst of a busy life, the practice of bringing radical acceptance to desire is essentially the same. We pause and relinquish our physical or mental pursuit of satisfaction long enough to recognize how our identity has contracted into the feelings and thoughts of a wanting self. In this pause, we let go of blaming ourselves for the presence of wanting and kindly allow it to exist, just as it is. We invite our wanting to tea, mindfully experiencing the sensations in our body, wakefully noting the emotions and thoughts that are arising in our mind. When we are present in this way, clear, compassionate, neither grasping nor resisting, we undo the habitual patterns of reactivity that keep our body, heart, and mind bound in wanting. In doing so, we enlarge our freedom to choose how we live. What we really want. The great Tibetan yogi Milarepa spent many years living in isolation in a mountain cave. As part of his spiritual practice, Milarepa began to see the contents of his mind as visible projections. His inner demons of lust, passion, and aversion would appear before him as gorgeous, seductive women and terrifying, wrathful monsters. In the face of these temptations and horrors, rather than being overwhelmed, Milarepa would sing out, "It is wonderful you came today. You should come again tomorrow. From time to time, we should converse." Through his years of intense training, Milarepa learns that suffering only comes from being seduced by the demons or from trying to fight them. To discover freedom in their presence, he has to experience them directly and wakefully as they are. In one story of his feats, Milarepa's cave becomes filled with demons. Facing the most persistent, domineering demon in the crowd, Milarepa makes a brilliant move. He puts his head into the demon's mouth. In that moment of full surrender, all the demons vanish. All that remains is the brilliant light of pure awareness. As Pema Chodron puts it, "When the resistance is gone, the demons are gone." Without a doubt, I had been in full resistance to the desires fueling my Vipassana romance. They were demons that in my eyes were consuming my spiritual life. When I finally recognized the battle I was in, the story of Milarepa came to mind. Perhaps my Vipassana romance was not the enemy of my meditation practice after all, but a natural experience that could serve my awakening. What would it be like to greet the demon of desire, to converse with it as Milarepa had? I became committed to dropping my resistance so I could get to know this energy that was driving the wanting self. Over the next few days, each time I realized I'd been lost in one of my flights of romantic illusion, I would note it as erotic fantasy and pay close attention to the sensations in my body and the emotions that were arising. No longer avoiding my immediate experience, I would find myself filled with waves of excitement, sexual arousal, and fear. Now, instead of resisting these feelings as demons, I just practiced accepting them, and with some curiosity, exploring them further. The pressing ache in my chest opened into a deep grief. Grief for all the lost moments of love, moments that I had missed because I was too preoccupied or busy to stop and open to them. I moved back and forth between erotic passion and this profound grieving about how separate I felt from what I really longed for. When the sensations of craving or sorrow became particularly intense, I tended to become lost again, thinking about what was missing in my life, fantasizing about ways I might fulfill my longing for love. While I didn't judge the fantasies as bad, I could see how they prevented me from being in touch with my actual experience. They kept me from tender presence, the gateway to what I most deeply longed for. Although I became less immersed in my stories, I could see I was still holding on, trying to control the charged energies moving through me. My habitual reins, tightening my body, entertaining a running commentary on what I was doing, stopped me from letting go into the intensity and hugeness of wanting. I wasn't sure how to allow myself to love freely, without any notions or constraints. I didn't know exactly what I loved, but I knew I needed to release the resistance that was strangling my heart. Instead of focusing all that longing on a particular person, I wanted to experience the immensity of its reach. Late one evening, I sat meditating alone in my room. My attention moved deeper and deeper into longing, until I felt as if I might explode with its heartbreaking urgency. Yet at the same time, I knew that was exactly what I wanted. I wanted to die into longing, into communion, into love itself. At that moment, I could finally let my longing be all that it was. I even invited it. Go ahead, please, be as full as you are. I was putting my head in the mouth of the demon. I was saying yes, surrendering wakefully into the wilderness of sensations, surrendering into the very embrace I was longing for. Like a child finally held close in her mother's arms, I relaxed so fully that all boundaries of body and mind dissolved. In an instant, I felt as if my body and mind were expanding out boundlessly in all directions, a flowing, changing stream of vibration, pulsing, tingling. Nothing separated me from this stream. Letting go entirely into rapture, I felt as open as the universe, wildly alive and as radiant as the sun. Nothing was solid in this dazzling celebration of life energy. I knew then that this was the fullness of loving what I love. Kabir, the 15th century Sufi poet, writes, "The universe is shot through in all parts by a single sort of love." This love is what we long for. When we bring radical acceptance to the enormity of desire, allowing it to be as it is, neither resisting it nor grasping after it, the light of our awareness dissolves the wanting self into its source. We find that we are naturally and entirely in love. Nothing is apart or excluded from this living awareness. Over the next few days, each time I opened deeply to the force of longing, I was filled with a refreshed and unconditional appreciation for all of life. In the afternoons, I would go outside after sitting and walk in the snowy woods. I found a sense of belonging with the great Douglas firs, with the chickadees that landed and ate seeds from my hands, with the layered sounds of the stream as it flowed around ice and rocks. Rumi writes, "A strange passion is moving in my head. My heart has become a bird, which searches in the sky. Every part of me goes in different directions. Is it really so, that the one I love is everywhere?" The one I love was everywhere, including within me. When we don't fixate on a single, limited object of love, we discover that the wanting self dissolves into the awareness that is love loving itself. A few weeks after returning home from retreat, I went to a conference and ran into the man who had been the object of my passionate fantasies. We had lunch together, and I could feel the distinct heat of attraction between us. But now that I was actually spending real time with him, I could also see the very glaring reasons why we weren't going to become a romantic couple. Nonetheless, when I was home alone that evening, my mind started circling once again around the possibilities of how we might get together. Because this kind of desire was now familiar, I was willing to pause. I knew that unobserved it would only fuel the wanting self. I named what was happening Desire Story and sat down on my meditation cushion. Immediately, thoughts about pursuing the relationship came up, and I could sense the instant contraction into an incomplete wanting self. When I opened out of the mental movies, I could again feel the aliveness, the pulsing and vibrating, the sadness and yearning that were right there in the moment. As at retreat, I let myself inhabit the longing. I relaxed and let it live fully through me. In the brightness of its flare, I could again sense the brightness of my own heart. It was true that I wanted to be in a romantic relationship with someone out there. It was even more deeply true that the communion I longed for was available in that very moment. If I remained awake to this communion, desires might energize and guide my attention, but they wouldn't blind me to the fullness and beauty that are already here. The Buddha taught that by being aware of desire, we free ourselves from identifying with it. With radical acceptance, we begin to shed the layers of shame and aversion we have built around our deficient, wanting self. We see through the stories we have created, stories about a self who is a victim of desire, about a self who is fighting desire, about a self who tumbles into unhealthy desires, about a self who has to have something more, something different from what is right here, right now. Radical acceptance dissolves the glue that binds us as a small self and frees us to live from the vibrant fullness of our being. Longing, felt fully, carries us to belonging. The more times we traverse this path, feeling the loneliness or craving and inhabiting its immensity, the more the longing for love becomes a gateway into love itself. Our longings don't disappear, nor does the need for others. But by opening into the well of desire, again and again, we come to trust the boundless love that is its source. Guided reflection, not doing when we feel driven by wanting. While grasping onto what we desire is part of our conditioning, it blinds us to our deeper longings and keeps us trapped in craving. Freedom begins when we pause and pay close attention to our experience. Reflect on an area of your life where you feel compelled by wanting mind. It might be food, cigarettes, alcohol, sex, voicing critical remarks, computer games, work, or buying things. For 1 week, let your intention be to practice pausing when you feel the urge to enact that behavior. When you pause, become physically still and pay close attention to the nature of wanting. What does your body feel like when wanting is strong? Where do you experience the sensations of wanting most fully? Do you feel them as butterflies in the stomach, as agitation in the chest, as aching in the arms? Do you feel as if you are leaning forward, tumbling into the future? Is your mind tight and speedy, or sluggish and dull? Notice if your experience changes during the minute or so of pausing. You might ask yourself, "What is missing right now?" and listen with your heart. If, following the pause, you move into the behavior, do so slowly and mindfully. Do you feel tension or excitement, self-judgment or fear? Notice with a clear and compassionate attention the sensations, emotions, and thoughts that may arise. While we might still pursue what we want after the pause, At least we do so aware of some of the tension and suffering that lie under our desires. Because all experience keeps changing. With time, even cravings that have felt irresistible can eventually dissolve. While desire naturally arises again, the wisdom of seeing that everything passes is liberating. Observing desire without acting on it enlarges our freedom to choose how we live. Guided reflection. Discovering your deepest longing. When we bring our myriad wants into the light of awareness, beneath them we find a deep and authentic wellspring of spiritual yearning. These core longings guide us on the path of awakening and freedom. Sit comfortably, in a way that allows you to be present and at ease. When you feel settled, ask yourself, "What does my heart long for?" Your initial answer might be that you want to be healthy, to lose weight, to make more money, to find a partner. Ask again and listen deeply, accepting whatever spontaneously arises. Continue in this way for several minutes, asking yourself the question, pausing and paying attention in an accepting and non-reactive way. Perhaps your answer will begin to deepen and simplify. Be patient and relaxed. With time, as you listen to your heart, your deepest longing will emerge. This longing might be expressed as the longing for love, presence, peace, communion, harmony, beauty, truth, or freedom. When you recognize what you most deeply and truly long for in this moment, surrender to that longing wakefully. Say yes, allowing the energy of your deepest longing to fill your body, to suffuse your heart and awareness. What is your experience like when you fully inhabit your deepest longing? Continue to meditate, experiencing longing with an open and embodied presence. This beautiful reflection can also be explored between two people. Sit comfortably, facing each other. Decide who will be first in the role of questioner and who will respond. After a time of becoming quiet and relaxed, one person gently asks, "What does your heart long for?" And the other responds by saying aloud what first comes to mind. Whatever the answer, the questioner simply says, "Thank you," bows or otherwise acknowledges the response, and then asks the question again. This continues for an agreed-upon length of time. Before you switch roles, pause for several moments of silence so that the person who has been answering the question can inhabit his or her experience of deepest longing with a full and embodied awareness. In the same way, after the second person has had a turn responding to the question, take a few moments of silence. When the meditation is complete, you might spend a few minutes sharing your individual experience. At any moment throughout the day, if you find yourself driven by wanting, the question, "What does my heart really long for?" will help you reconnect to the purity of spiritual yearning. By pausing and asking yourself at any moment, "What really matters? What do I most care about?" you awaken your naturally caring heart. 7. Opening our heart in the face of fear. We have to face the pain we have been running from. In fact, we need to learn to rest in it and let its searing power transform us. Charlotte Jocko Beck. When Barbara came to me for therapy, meditation had become so unpleasant for her that she wondered if she should continue to practice. Frightening scenes from her childhood had begun to invade her morning sitting, leaving her shaken and distraught. Barbara had just returned from her first 10-day retreat, and although she had been meditating regularly for little over a year, nothing this disturbing had happened before. Meditation had been a refuge for Barbara. She didn't want to let it go, but she just wasn't able to handle what was coming up. She told me about one particular image that kept emerging in her meditation sittings. She and her mother had talked about the incident a number of times, and now, whether the images arose from her memory or her imagination wasn't important. They were triggering